And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday afternoon. At the start of her book, The Reluctant Republican, My Fight for the Moderate Majority, attorney and former congressional candidate Barbara Olshner says she thought of herself as a traditional conservative in the vein of Barry Goldwater. She ran as a Republican from Florida's Panhandle, District 2, in 2010. The district's main population is in Panama City and the state capital of Tallahassee. She was trounced, and her book chronicles the story. Barbara Olshner joins us from Vernon, Florida. Welcome to you, Barbara.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Welcome to you. Barbara, tell us a little about your background and why you decided to leave your successful practice as a trial attorney for almost three decades and jump into the political arena.
Well, it was never anything that I had really imagined doing. I did not have a desire to be in politics, but I do believe in service to your country. And it just came about that the way things were in my life, I had an opportunity where I had a window of time to be able to pursue this. I closed down my law practice in Alabama in 2001, and really for the next 10 years worked on very large, complex cases all over the country. And these cases would last 3 to 4 years at a time. And I finished up one in 2009, and someone talked to me about this seat in the Panhandle and really said, it's a chance for you to do something for your country. And that really sort of struck a chord with me because I believe we should all contribute in some form, some way. And so that was the reason that I threw my hat into the ring. I was very naive. I was idealistic. But I was used to talking to men and women every day because I was a stand-up trial lawyer. I was not a corporate lawyer pushing papers. And I really believe that the same men and women that served on juries and who I believe, and in my experience, 90% of the time did the correct thing, I thought those would be the voters. I was right. It was the same people, but I was wrong that they would use the same analysis in politics as they did in serving on a jury.
Now, the district, Congressional District 2, has been a white Democratic seat for 130 years, and Alan Boyd was considered the incumbent Alan Boyd was considered a blue dog Democrat and was targeted by Sarah Palin. So you thought there would be a good chance for a Republican victory then?
Well, I did, and actually, before he was targeted, I got into the race. And I thought that he was weak because the area really was more conservative than Alan was. He had honestly done a good job for the district in many ways, but his votes on Obamacare, on the TARP program, and on cap and trade had hurt him in the district.
I heard you say, Barbara, that the passage of the Affordable Care Act, now that you mentioned it, was your impetus to enter the race. Why was that?
Well, a lot of my background, Bonnie, was in medical issues. I had worked with a team of lawyers on NRA Managed Care, which was representing all the physicians and medical associations in the country against the HMOs. So I was one of many lawyers. It was a large class action. A lot of lawyers were involved. But a lot of my background was in this area, there were a lot of problems with that bill that I saw, not from a partisan point of view, but from a practical, pragmatic point of view that I thought was poorly done. And I think when President Obama had both houses and he pushed through this bill that did not really do what it needed to do, I thought that it was a real problem and would be seen as a real weakness and would politically backfire on him. I thought it was bad legislation, quite honestly, and I think we get the best legislation, such as the 1964 Civil Rights Act, when we have both parties actually participating in and having to work together. And in that instance, of course, moderation is my theme. Senator Dirksen, who was a moderate Republican, was actually instrumental in passing the Civil Rights Act and getting an agreement between the Democrats and the Republicans. I think that's what's sorely missing today in my party, and it's sorely what's missing in Washington, and I think we need the moderates and the centrists to step back up and get back into the mix.
Now, in 2010, you came in last in the primary for that seat in District 2. Tell us about your opponents. Give us a thumbnail on each one.
Well, actually, I say I came in dead last, and I'm not ashamed of being last. And also, you know, my career as a trial lawyer, and my before that, I was a professional tennis player. Losing and winning, something I've done all my life. I'm not ashamed to have lost, because that's just a part of the game. And I don't want anyone to think this is a book about losing. That's not important. The four men who were my opponents, each was more conservative than the next. I like to say, and which is true, I lost to an undertaker, a commercial pilot, a drug salesman, and a cowboy inventor who liked to say he was a cross between Ronald Reagan and John Wayne. I never really knew exactly what that meant. I don't think anybody else knew what it meant. But they could not be more rabid, more to the right. The comments they made, I laugh about it and I sort of make light of it in the book, but quite frankly and honestly was shocking to me. I didn't think people really spoke like that anymore. I didn't think they would be so derogatory of people who were different from them, whether it was illegal aliens, women, homosexuals, Muslims, anyone who differed from this very staunch ideological stand. Was a source of derision in all their comments. It surprised me, one, that the men would do it. It surprised me more that the audience would applaud.
Why would you say there's so little tolerance of differing viewpoints in among these candidates or in the party now?
You know, Colin Powell said there's a deep vein of intolerance that runs in the Republican Party, and I think it's better if I quote him as opposed to me. I think it's I don't know what the reason is. The underlying psychological reason, I think, takes somebody more than me. But it is a fight for the status quo. And what I realized when I talked to so many different people is that they want their America. I talk about that when I met a young man at the Tea Party who got very threatening with me and rather aggressive. And he wanted a congressman or woman, he said, who would go to Congress and not budge. Right or wrong, wouldn't budge. And so we get into a conversation about that, and I quite frankly say to him, I'm not your candidate, because if I think I'm wrong, I'll change. This was very, very upsetting to him, to the fact that he came back later and was somewhat threatening and menacing. But what I realized, what was really important, is what I saw in that conversation with him. Was that people are so entrenched about what I call, quote, my America. It's not our America. It's not this huge melting pot. It's not this concern for our brothers and sisters, our neighbors. It's not a concern for others. It's a real desperate, deep concern for myself and those who are like me, which is why they can only elect people who are like them, because it's all they trust.
I was struck in your book, Barbara Olschner, about the campaign heckler that you came across, and quoting her, standing in the middle of a road is a way to get hit by cars going both directions. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, it was at a event, a campaign event, and this was this old woman. They made me cut it out of the book. I don't know why, but she had this really raspy, husky voice from smoking too many cigarettes and drinking too much of some kind of strong alcohol. But she did scream out at me, and she said, you know, standing in the middle of the road is a good way to get hit by cars going both ways. And I was just stunned, because a lot of the times and you have to realize my background was jurors, was the common person sitting on a jury, and I don't care where they came from, they could understand with reason and logic laws and complicated facts, and I was my experience in front of juries was very successful. So I was so shocked by this kind of retort from people, and I admit I was shocked into silence. I just thought, well, I can't even understand that. I later wished that I had remembered President Eisenhower's quote, one of my favorite quotes that I love so much, where he says, you know, the middle of the road is the only usable surface. The extremes left and right are the gutters. And I think we need to remember that, especially in my party. And I am not here to be critical of the Democrats. I'm not a member of that team. I don't go to that church. And it's up to them to sort themselves out however they want to. I think it's up to me to try to be a strong voice for the Republican Party, to be who this great party has been since Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt. We have a great history, and the current Republican Party is an anomaly to the history of the Republican Party. But the moderates, and there are many, many of them, and centrists, have got to step up, step forward, get involved, or we're going to lose. Our party's going to go down, I believe, and it looks like it's going down every week, every year.
Did you consider becoming an independent in light of what was happening during your campaign?
You know, I did. I really thought about that. I was advised to do that at one point because I could not speak truthfully. At one debate when I said on immigration, you know, the Republican Party needs the right policy, but more than that, we need the right attitude. I was almost booed off the stage. I was called Barbara Boxer, too liberal, she's not going to Washington. And I thought, my goodness gracious, that seemed to me so reasonable. Even though that they are here illegally, they, you know, and I was stunned that I had to talk to so many people and remind them that the illegal aliens are still human beings and need to be treated that way. I couldn't even believe I had to language it that way. Mm. And at that point, I did think of becoming an independent, and I called one of my great friends and talked to him, and he gave me sound advice, I thought, that made me stay in the race. And that was, we don't need good, strong leaders to quit. And I do believe in the principles of the Republican Party. I'm just more pragmatic and practical about them, and I don't think that those principles always solve problems. You have to solve the problem that's in front of you, not just hold on to an ideology and go down with the ship. I keep using that analogy, but I think the reasons are obvious.
We're speaking with Barbara Olschner. She was a trial attorney for 28 years and ran for Congress in 2010. The name of her book is The Reluctant Republican, My Fight for the Moderate Majority. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back, take some calls and your emails. Stay with us.
And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we rejoin former congressional candidate Barbara Olschner. And, of course, she's written The Reluctant Republican, My Fight for the Moderate Majority. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. Our number, 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Or email, that's radio at WLRN.org.
Or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. Barbara, you said that with enough money, any candidate can make an inane statement and be catapulted into office. So what role did money play in your run and that of your opponent's run for Congress?
Well, this was really a smaller media area so that you could raise less money in this district and still be a viable candidate. I didn't raise the money that I needed to raise, and I'm quite candid about that in the book. It was hard to do. But the money was not astronomical like it is in a lot of district races. I think the top person, you know, maybe raised $300,000, which is not a lot, and I could be wrong. I don't have that to memory exactly. But if you could get the backing of enough people, I also make the point in the book, and I think that this is true, is that no amount of money, I think I could have raised $2 million. I don't think that was the problem. Moderates were probably less than 10%. And the other thing is only a third of the registered Republican voters showed up to vote in this primary, which is pretty much the norm. So out of 150,000 Republicans, 50,000 showed up. I don't know what the other 100,000 were doing. I don't know where they are on the scale. But I do know that I think that moderates think they don't have candidates, tend to withdraw, tend to not participate, and they tend to be, quite frankly, moderate in temperament. So, you know, they don't that right now the right wing of the Republican Party is the only faction that really has the microphone, it has the media interest, and it gets the money. And if the moderates in the Republican Party care about having two strong parties, they are the ones that are going to have to step forward.
I see you've started this nonprofit organization, these Purple Moderates. What is it? And what do you hope to accomplish? You still have that?
Yes, yes. We're working on that, and we're in the middle of doing grant work and trying to get money for that. Purple, of course, is a combination of red and blue, and we're trying to get moderates in both parties to come together and be a voice, because what I know from the demographics in the 2012 presidential election is that centrist and moderates can change the outcome of any national election. The numbers are there, but people have to participate. And I think the slogan of Purple Moderates is, if you're politically moderate, say so. And I say that in the book, that if you are moderate, first of all, the least you could do is just say so and stand up and say, you know, I'm more moderate than that. I think that's really needed. I quite honestly took a beating. I've taken beatings before. I'm sure I'll take some more before my life is over. That's what's going to have to happen. There's going to have to be a tide. And I talk about in the book as well, numerous times in history where people have to stand up and that rank and file have to fall down, somebody else has to step up. I think it is of critical importance in this country for us to have two strong parties. I don't want to leave and become an independent, although I can foresee one day I might have to. It is my hope that I'm not going to leave. But I think we need two strong parties to get really, if our objective is, as it should be, to solve problems, we've got to have two strong parties who can work together and solve problems for the greater good and stop all this political pandering that's just done to feather people's political careers.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. We're speaking with Barbara Olschner. Scott in Miami, you're up. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
I wanted to say bravo, Barbara. I'm agreeing with, I think, everything you say. I'm a Republican. I registered back in 78 as a Republican. I have been ever since, but I couldn't be more disappointed with the twists and turns our party has taken. It's absolutely a shame. And for us to have such a one-sided agenda within the party, I think it's awful. And I applaud you for what you're saying, and I would be curious, what would just a regular garden variety person like myself do in order to make a difference? What do you say?
Well, you know, I think we've got, that's why I formed Purple Moderates as a 501c4 political organization. I want people to join it, and I want them to get people who are like-minded to join it. So my goal is to get 6 million people to join Purple Moderates so that we have a stronger voice, because right now we have no umbrella to stand under. We're not invited in our own party. We can't sit at the table, and we have no power. And people just, you know, I'm just a garden variety person too, but I know that, you know, one of my favorite verses is that a small rudder turns a mighty ship. And I know that if we band together and if we talk about those things that are important, I'm not afraid to compromise on issues to get work done. I come from the private sector, not the public sector. I don't want a career in politics, but I do want to contribute to my country. I mean, for people who care about those things, you know, that's what we need to do. We need to have a voice. For example, NoLabels.org is doing a great job in doing bipartisan legislation in Washington, and I'm working with them as well. But what I really want to do is have a grassroots organization that people can go to. The first thing we're doing is we're starting a global website that every moderate centrist link is on that one site that you can go to and find out whatever you want, find out about candidates, find out who's more moderate and practical. And we hope that eventually that we may form a PAC and support candidates who really believe in and are committed to working with the other side, whatever side you're on, in order to resolve issues for the greater good of the country rather than being so dedicated to one party.
Well said. But thank you very much.
And
I appreciate
thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate you. I didn't say thank you. I'm every time I do this and I meet someone like you, I'm so glad I've done it. So thank you.
It's truly a pleasure, and please keep up the good work. I'll have to look for this website, Purple Moderates.
Right, and you can go to my website, which is thereluctantrepublican.net, and we're working on the website. But go to reluctantrepublican.net and email me, and I'll keep you posted.
That sounds fine. And one last question, please. Do you have plans to run again?
You know, I don't have plans to run again. People keep asking me that, and I, you know, right now I don't think that's my contribution. But we'll just have to see. I hate to go back on my word, but I don't see it happening. I want to be a strong voice, and I don't want to be in today's society. You have to parse the truth if you're running for office. I'm not interested in that.
And we move along to Carlos. He's in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Hi. Who is this? Is this Carlos?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I just I thank you for your program, and I thank the lady on the show. I think I commend her for her comments and for her cause. I am originally from South America, Colombia, a democracy that learns democracy from the United States. And I grew up here as a kid from elementary through high school. And I learned in high school that through dialogue, not argument, that things could be resolved to compare the old Europe. And I just hate to see this fundamentalism destroying our country, our society, our way of life. As a matter of fact, I lived in Tucson, Arizona, and there is a right-wing radio station there creating hate all the time, and I feel that that's the reason why Giffords got shot and other people got shot, because of this right-wing fundamentalism. And, you know, this happened in Rwanda with a radio station, and I just think we can avoid a lot of trouble by just being civilized and going to our roots.
Okay, thank you, Carlos.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barbara.
Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you very much.
You know, the one thing I do say that I think is very important in my book is I don't want to really change what anyone believes. And this is America, and you have the right to that. But there is one thing that we need to do, and that is we all need to be tolerant. I don't care if you're way far to the right. You have the right to be there, but you need to be tolerant. And I remind everybody that intolerance is not a right enshrined in the Constitution, and it has never been really what it means to be an American, to be intolerant of the views of others.
Speaking of the Constitution, you quote the Constitution at the beginning of each of your chapters, and I'm assuming it's because you respect the Constitution. Do you think those on the right are trying to circumvent it as much as you do think those on the left are?
You know, Bonnie, in my book, really, I do sort of do some passing mention of Obamacare, but it's not a criticism so much of the left. I think, and it really, my criticism is of my own party. And what the problem is, and I think this is a huge problem, the people on the right are really only interested in their personal preference. And they have to submit their personal preference to the authority of the Constitution. We are not a true democracy. We are a constitutional republic. That means that the Constitution has the authority in this country. And we can't vote out, for example, by majority, freedom of religion. We can't, I don't care how many people vote to do away with the First Amendment, it can't be passed. So we are subjected to the rights and privileges and obligations under the Constitution. And what I see is wrong, and I'll give you a great example. When I was running, my candidates kept talking about blowing up the mosque that was going to be built at near Ground Zero. Mm. And I kept saying, and they kept saying, the candidates, I'm going to fight this. And I kept saying, you can't. You cannot make any law abridging a religion. They have the right to build that wherever they want to. That's what the Constitution said. And the audience is the one that really upset me with this, because they gave me such hard looks, and they said, you know, we don't care. We really don't care. We want it the way we want it. And this is a huge problem. And part of this is we don't teach civics in schools anymore. We don't have that half semester mandatory. And so everyone is running around using their personal preference to decide how they feel about certain issues rather than, I mean, I have my personal preference like everyone does on all issues, but the Constitution gets the final say, not how I feel about something. And I think that's the problem with the right wing of the Republican Party. They neither know nor abide by the Constitution if it is opposite to their personal preference.
How about your constitutional views and gun control?
Well, you know, I think that's it's a really complex issue. Under the Heller decision, you know, the Second Amendment says that we have the right to bear arms, and you know, have the right to have guns. But I don't see. You know, I wrote a piece about that that's on Hip Hop Republicans. I'm a contributor to that on the issue of gun control. Although you have the right to own guns, it doesn't say that you have the right to own every gun ever made. It doesn't say that you have a right to have cannons and everything in the world. So there's got to be some reasonable and rational basis for that within the dictates of the Constitution. And having... You know, I think we have, what, by last count, 300 million guns in the United States, enough for every man, woman, and child. Certainly, the practical approach to that has to be you can't possibly believe everybody is competent enough in this country to own a gun. And we, you know, I personally was in favor of background checks. It was ludicrous to say that a national registry would affect constitutional rights. We have a registry of a lot of things, such as automobiles. The government knows where our automobiles are. Nobody's afraid they're going to come take them. So a lot of these things are arguments are silly, but they appeal to people. And I had a lot of people ask me, you're not going to take away my guns, are you? And I said, I don't even know if you have guns.
What were some of the other issues that were raised and debated during your congressional race, and were they substantive?
No. I thought that we were going to – I worked so hard – Because I worked it like I did a lawsuit. I knew my facts. I knew the law. I was prepared on these issues. And that's not what we talked about. We talked about who was the best American, who had military service, who went to church and taught Sunday school, whose mother, aunt, uncle had died of cancer, every personal issue you could think of, how long somebody had lived in a county. There was not one substantive conversation on any issue that was important to any of the issues that we were deciding. And it was, you know, and I go back to my earlier statement, the voters were looking for who's the most like me. And there was a time in our country where we thought we should elect the best and brightest, and that those would be the best people to solve our problems. But my opponents said that I was a rocket scientist, I was too smart to go to Congress, things weren't that bad, we didn't need anybody that smart. And I said, it looks kind of bad to me. I think we need the smartest person we can find. But that anti-intellectual sentiment played to the voters because they don't trust people who are different from them. That's my experience.
And another caller, this is Dwight in Pembroke Pines. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing? You know, I can't say that I don't love watching the Republican Party go through these death fits because, you know, the amount of transformation that's going to happen for that party to even become relevant. I mean, yeah, fine, they're getting elected, but, I mean, for the age of information, I mean, giving these people the mic is, like, the best thing that we can do. You know, I've had some of the most entertaining, like, you know, the rape comments that they were saying, you know, the closed-door, you know, fundraising sessions that people were videotaping. I mean, the bombastic speeches that were coming out of this, it's like, goodness, I mean, no one in the right mind would do that. So, I say to your guest, who I greatly respect, you know, on so many levels, I can commend her for her efforts, but, you know, she made the ship analogy. That ship is not so much. I would start your own ship. I think that there's a general consensus that people are sensibly minded. I consider myself an independent, but I voted for Obama. But, you know, I'll vote for whoever I think can get the job done. But, you know, right now, the Republican Party is going to have to transform. I mean, okay, Marco Rubio. I mean, that's the only lever that they could pull. I mean, you know, we have women, black, gay. I mean, we have the Democratic Party is so deep and diverse. I mean, you're going to have to come up with something extraordinary to even come close to competing with them on a national level. No, I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Okay, thanks.
No, I think you're very right. I mean, the growth and opportunity report that the GOP did in March of this year really agrees with everything that you said, Dwight. And, you know, there was a new report out today by the College Republicans, the National Committee survey, and that the younger voters, they say they don't like the closed-minded, racist, rigid, old-fashioned GOP, and that's a real wake-up call. And here's one other thing, I really want to make, is that the Republican Party is spending $10 million, apparently, to do an outreach program to all these minorities or diversities, if you will, that don't exist in the GOP. But the real problem is they're not reaching out to people within their own party. There are plenty of moderates, blacks, women, Hispanics, in their own party, but if you are moderate, they're not reaching out to you, and it's rather like a team going out to recruit and not playing everybody who's sitting on the bench. We have wonderful people such as former Governor John Huntsman, who didn't make a dent in the presidential primary circus of 2012, primarily because he is smart, accomplished, and really a centrist.
Do you see any other leaders that are potentially able to, you know, fulfill what you perceive as what the party should be?
Well, I think it's going to take people being really strong and standing up and saying, I care more about the message I'm sending than whether I'm going to get elected. I think Jeb Bush could do this if he would, but he would have to give up running for president to say our party really, he tried to do it earlier in the year when he said his father wouldn't be really comfortable in today's GOP. He needs to be stronger on that. He could be a leader, but I think he has to give up any hope of running. Chris Christie is someone who I think could stand up, and I think who would stand up and say and talk about the nonsense there is. I think it was great that he was able to work with President Obama during the hurricane in Sandy, when Hurricane Sandy came through in New Jersey. That's what leaders need to do. They need to work with each other and get things done and not be so afraid that they're going to be associated with the president that the right doesn't like. That's really just silly.
Going back to 2012, though, you talked about that there weren't intelligent candidates. Certainly no one ever said that Mitt Romney wasn't intelligent, capable, and accomplished.
Well, I didn't really say that. I mean, I don't think that there was anyone as accomplished as Governor Huntsman when you look at him as ambassador to China. If you look at his two successful terms in Utah and what he did there as a businessman, I mean, Mitt Romney was certainly accomplished, and I'm not saying he wasn't smart, but my take on Mitt Romney is he was scared to death of the base. He has good reason to be. They are voracious against anyone who's a moderate, and I think that if he needed to stand up and say, look, the truth is I'm a moderate. If you're not going to elect me, you're not, but this is how I plan to govern, I think he would have done a lot better. But I don't think you can run being afraid of this right-wing base. Now, they will beat you up, and they may not elect you, but that's just, people are going to have to sacrifice themselves to keep fighting against as Colin Powell said, the deep vein of intolerance. That's what's unacceptable. It's not unacceptable they have a different opinion, but that they are intolerant is unacceptable.
And we'll take another call. This is Remy.
Yeah.
Turn down your radio, please.
Yeah. Okay. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, good afternoon. I'm a Democrat. I look at it, and I don't really see a place for moderation in the Republican Party. that the person that comes to my head as to realizing that, and we welcome him into the market, in the Democratic Party, is Chris Christie. I'm surprised that you haven't considered the same path that he took, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, because we have some phone problems.
Bad connection.
Well, she just mentioned Chris Christie.
She did mention Chris Christie.
Yeah, I don't know what else I can say. I do think Chris Christie is a moderate, and I think that he would be a good stand for the moderate Republican. I think he's strong enough to say what he thinks and to follow through on it.
And before we break, we'll take another call. This is Don in Miami. Hi.
Hi, Joe.
Hello.
I'm Dolchner. From a perspective of psychology, the dominance of extremists in the Republican Party are a result of a fear bubble over the growing awareness that white Anglo-Saxon Protestant dominance of American life and power is coming to an end. Statistics prove that. As this awareness grows, both conscious and subconscious, fear has grown into a bubble which is beginning to burst. The Civil Rights Act, banning of prayer in public schools, and Roe versus Wade mark the beginning of the bubble. Fortunately, time will heal this faulty pattern of extreme behavior, which cannot stand forever against facts, evidence, and in the light of our Constitution. And that's my comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break on our program. This is Topical Currents. We're speaking with former congressional candidate Barbara Olchner. Her book is The Reluctant Republican, My Fight for the Moderate Majority. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Barbara Olchner. She is a former congressional candidate. The name of her book, The Reluctant Republican, My Fight for the Moderate Majority. And we're going to take some more calls. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Barbara Olchner, going back to 2010 in this congressional primary race, District 2 in Florida's Panhandle, when did you realize you were going to lose and lose big? When did you get an inkling?
I didn't realize I was, I knew I was going to lose fairly soon. I knew I was going to lose probably by April. And that was the time that I had to make the decision to file as an independent or file as a Republican. If I had filed as an independent, I would have been on the main ballot for November and would have bypassed the Republican primary. I didn't really think I would lose big necessarily, and I think one of the people who worked on my campaign said we don't know how many thoughtful Republicans are out there, because that's the only votes you're going to get. And I didn't know till really the last day that I was going to be dead last. I mean, but I knew I was going to lose as early as April, and I, as I say in the book, I mean, I could have walked away. I could have just said, this is just not going to work for me. But what I saw, it seemed to me to be so important that somebody stand up and give out this message and to play it through to the end and see really what the result would be. I didn't really know what the complete outcome would be. I knew I wasn't going to win. But I thought it was worth a fight, and I thought that every opportunity was an opportunity to try to talk to people about doing a reasonable, practical, thoughtful approach to the issues that faced us. And it's the reason I wrote the book, too. I've never written a book before, but I wrote this book because I believe this message is important, like some of the callers who have called in. I believe there are more of us out there than we know, and that we have to be willing to stand up for this message. And I believe this is my contribution and was a lot more important than me winning this race.
So you're optimistic.
I am optimistic. But I am an optimistic person, but I believe that you fight for things that are good and that are right. I believe the success of America is worth fighting for. I believe solving problems for forever is really, really important, not solving problems for today. I really think that the public has got to get rid of and sick of these narcissistic politicians who are just addicted to the limelight, and start to go back and allow people who are our best and brightest to make really great decisions. You know, Olympia Snowe resigned from the Senate last year saying there's no more center in American politics, that there's no more ability to do this. We've got to get back to a center for the greater good of everybody. I believe that's worth fighting for. So, yes, I am optimistic.
And we move along to Charles in Coconut Creek. Thanks for your patience, Charles. Hi.
Hi, thank you, and thank you very much for your show. Very much like a show you had on a couple of weeks where some gentleman was talking about two presidents.
Right.
If you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm really getting annoyed with this whole idea that it's just two parties, that our American Constitution only, you know, can afford two parties. I think I'm a member of the Green Party, or registered as a Green Party person. I think the environment is our most important issue. Without a healthy environment, nothing will work. But I don't, you know, necessarily, I didn't vote for Obama, but I did vote for the Democratic congressman in my district. And I don't, you know, think that there should only be three parties either. I just think that this way politicians would be able to speak their mind freely without having to worry about offending, you know, whoever their fundraisers are, etc. And that's my, I don't know if that's a question or what, but that's my comment.
Barbara?
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that limits the number of parties we have. We can have as many parties as we want. I think it's just the way, practically speaking, and I don't disagree really with Charles, but practically speaking, the way we are set up now, we are set up with two strong parties and then a number of other parties that are weaker in terms of fundraising and dollars and members. And I think it's, we don't want one strong party and a number of smaller, weaker parties. I don't think that's good either. So, you know, I'm fine if we had three parties or four parties. I don't care what number we have, but they need to be equal in the ability to fight and to talk and to dialogue and to compromise. And you only have that if you have opponents of equal weight. But that's the reason I don't want there to be just one strong party and a number of little parties trying to, you know, trip them at their ankles.
And this is Lucas in Miami. Hi. Lucas,
hello.
You're up.
Oh, how you doing? Yes, I wanted to ask you how you think big money has influenced the Republican Party towards the towards this movement towards the extreme right, and the base of the party and the candidates, how you think it has affected. Thank you. I take myself there.
Thank you, Lucas.
Thank you, Lucas. Yes, I think that, you know, there appear to be a number of billionaire conservatives, and I am looking for billionaire moderates. I mean, that's how this is going to be changed, I think. I don't know where the moderates are with money. Maybe they're just way far to the right or way far to the left, but these are the people who need to step up and help this party out. We don't, the effect of the conservative billionaires has really hurt the Republican Party.
And next caller, we've got Robert in Deerfield. Hi.
Hi. Barbara, you're a real trailblazer. I think it's fantastic. I was looking to cover your pictures. You're a great picture of you, too. When I speak to, I'm a Democrat, but I worked for Nelson Rockefeller in the 60s in Tennessee for a draft movement. And every time they're asked about something that's out of their comfort zone, like you said, it's those hard looks. It's that deer in the headlight view that they say they can't conceive, and they're looking for a lifeboat, and the only lifeboat they have is in a section of the Republican Party. And I'm looking to the 2016 election and the 2018 congressional election. No matter who we have as president, this group of individuals is getting smaller and more adamant. And there's a level of sadness that I see that nobody's addressing. You see that sadness among extreme viewpoints in the Republican Party that are not mainstream, and how can we turn that around?
I'm not sure I know what you mean, Robert, by sadness.
I mean, they have those hard looks. They can't conceive that the changes have occurred with the civil rights movement, with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and Condoleezza Rice, an African-American president in the White House, the health care issues, the space program. They feel that they're powerless, and that's that sadness. They feel that nothing's going to change.
Right, right. You know, I really believe that what is needed is a reconciliation in the Republican Party. And part of that is addressing, look, I'm compassionate with anybody who has any kind of loss, and I think a lot of people are. You know, Americans are known for being compassionate people, but we still, even with that compassion, have the ability to make the right decisions while still caring about our neighbors, our friends, our relatives, people who are different from us. That's a wonderful thing of what it is to be an American. And I really think that if there was anything that if the GOP wanted to know what I thought, and I can tell you they don't, but if they wanted to know what I thought, I would say spend the $10 million not on recruiting players who are not playing on your team, but spend it within your own party to reconcile these groups in your own party, the two or three progressive Republicans who are left, but the moderates, the centrists, those on the right, spend that time dialoguing, talking, give up the moniker of rhino because someone, Republican in name only, because someone doesn't agree with you. I mean, I've suggested we have a whole convention called Let the Rhinos Back into the Tent. I mean, let these people come forward and have a different opinion, a different viewpoint, and work with each other on why we believe this to come back and be the grand old party again.
Thank you, Barbara Olschner. She has written The Reluctant Republican, My Fight for the Moderate Majority. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with the story of Dara Zeledon. She surmounted armed robbery, a suicide, financial ruin, a life-threatening accident, and a brain tumor while pregnant. The girl with the crooked smile. Also, Linda Gassenheimer gives ideas for hurricane food during power outages. And the calendar. On this day in 1934, 79 years ago, the birth of journalist Bill Moyers in Hugo, Oklahoma. And on this day in 1949, 64 years ago, the birth of espionage thriller author Ken Follett in Wales. Eye of the Needle, On Wings of Eagles. And one more while we ponder the soprano saxophone and light jazz. On this day in 1956, 57 years ago, the birth of Kenny Gorelick. That is, Kenny G in Seattle. At age 17, Kenny G was part of Barry White's orchestra. Apologies to those callers, we couldn't get on the air this hour. And we leave with a thought from Bill Moyers, quote, "Democracy may not prove in the long run to be as efficient as other forms of government, but it has one saving grace. It allows us to know and say that it isn't." Joseph Cooper here for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.